Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
David Sterling was a young commando officer recovering in a hospital in Cairo from a parachuting accident. He had time on his hands to ponder the general failure of Special Forces operations in the Middle East at that time. Thus, in July 1941, L Detachment of the SAS Brigade came into being in Egypt.
Owen McGonigal was born in Dublin in 1920. In pre-partition Ireland, a Catholic by religion, he was brought up in Belfast, his father's birthplace. At the outbreak of World War II in 1939, he abandoned his law studies and joined the Royal Ulster Rifles. He ultimately became a commando and a founder member of the SAS. Blair Paddy Mayne's best mate, he's been brought back into the public's attention by the BBC's SAS Rogue Hero series. His brother Ambrose also joined up and served with distinction in World War II. He later became one of the best known judges during the Troubles. But who were Owen and Ambrose McGonigal? What were their motivations? What happened to them? And what is their legacy? I'm joined by Belfast Telegraph reporter Andrew Madden. Andrew, you're welcome once again to the Bell Tell.
Thanks for having me.
And just to remind the listeners that we have previously spoke about Blair Paddy Mayne. I know an awful lot of listeners were very interested in that, but if anyone hasn't got around to listening to that, you can find that on Apple, you can find that on Spotify, and of course you can find it on the Belfast Telegraph website. Owen McGonigal, he was Paddy Mayne's mate, I suppose, and that's perhaps why we're talking about him and why people may have heard of him, especially because of the recent BBC series. Who was he? What was his background?
Well, he was born in 1920 in Dublin. This would have been just before partition. Into a family of three boys. He had a brother, Ambrose, and an older brother, Richard, and four girls. He came from a long line of people in the legal profession. Now, his family moved to Belfast, which was his father's hometown. His father was John McGonigal, King's Counsel, in 1922. Now, John McGonigal, he would go on to become one of the chief crown prosecutor in Belfast. So he lived up in the Malone Road. But both Owen and Ambrose both attended boarding schools in the south. And like Blair Mayne, actually, they excelled in sport and did well academically. Ambrose, more proficient at rugby, and Owen would have specialised in cricket. Owen enrolled in Trinity College Dublin in 1938 to study law, like his father. But as a Catholic born in Dublin, in theory, he wasn't actually permitted to attend Trinity because the Catholic hierarchy in Ireland at the time had banned Irish Catholics from attending the university for up to 99 years, and only removed that ban back in 1970, so it was reserved generally for Protestants. So Owen enrolled under his family's Belfast address, so that's why he was able to go to Trinity, but he wasn't there very long. Both Ambrose and Owen joined the Royal Ulster Rifles in Ballymena at the outbreak of the Second World War in 1939. Now, it was in Ballymena with the Royal Ulster Rifles that Owen and Ambrose became close friends with Blair Mayne. Ambrose had actually met him previously by playing rugby at Queen's University. Now, the trio became close, and then they would visit each other's families on breaks and whatnot. Then in June 1940, both Blair and Owen were posted to the Scottish Rifles. and they find themselves in Aberdeenshire in Scotland.
Both Owen and Ambrose, at the outbreak of war, enthusiastically give up their studies or whatever they were doing at the time and joined up. And obviously, it's the SAS link, especially to Owen. Ambrose actually was a member of the SBS.
Their sister squadron.
And I suppose a Catholic born in Dublin by the name of Owen McGonagall, a lot of people mightn't automatically assume, you know, that that might be someone who would...
No, not at all, not at all. But they did have like family members who had served in the British Army in the decades previous, several of them actually. And there seemed to be fairly little debate on whether or not to sign up. It was very much they thought it was their calling.
But I suppose...
But yes, in terms of his background.
That background, it all may not be as it seems to us looking back and to, perhaps with the prejudice of the Troubles and history. They were Catholics, but they were very well off Catholics.
They were, yeah.
And they were perhaps very loyal to the establishment. It's not entirely clear what their politics was, but I think the point I'm making is perhaps we shouldn't be completely surprised by this.
Of course not, yeah. I think like Blair Mayne, Owen and Ambrose, they saw themselves first and foremost as Ulstermen, even though they were born in Dublin and whatnot, but their father was an Ulsterman. They moved there from a very young age to Belfast and grew up there, obviously with stints in boarding school down south and whatnot, but first and foremost, they saw themselves as Ulstermen.
So I think the point is that, especially at that stage, that people in Dublin and people, that there are the loyalties perhaps were not as clear-cut as people would imagine them today.
Yeah, very much so.
So it may not have been as atypical as we are assuming. But Ambrose and Paddy and Owen, they end up in Aberdeenshire.
Actually, Ambrose didn't. Ambrose had broken his leg during training while motorcycling, and he opted to remain in Northern Ireland with the Royal Ulster Rifles at the time. So it was just Blair and Owen that went over to Aberdeenshire. And then the pair, both Owen and Blair, then they joined, which was the newly formed at the time, Number 11 Scottish Commando. And then they were shipped over to the Iron Isles in Scotland to undergo rigorous training.
So what people may be aware of the word commando, but the commandos were a new thing in World War II. Winston Churchill certainly took the credit for the idea, whether that's true or not. What were they?
Well, essentially, they were just an elite special forces unit. They underwent specialist training, and they would have underwent a lot more rigorous training than, say, just the regular British Army units, because they were sent for special missions, and they would have been, you know, a smaller force and used more accurately in pinpointed attacks, oftentimes behind enemy lines, which was kind of set the template for the SAS to a degree in the years that would come.
So I suppose that's a very normal... This is we hear of special forces and elite forces, but at the time it was quite a new thing, and they looked for special types of characters, you know, beyond the normal soldier, I suppose, a normal person called up. And
well, they definitely took a special kind of person. Yeah,
Blair Mayne and Owen McGonagall were certainly those that kind of person, and we talked about Paddy Mayne getting away with an awful lot.
Oh, 100%, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So what went on in Ireland?
Well, this the setting up of the commandos, this, you had to remember, followed the withdrawal from Dunkirk in May and June 1940. Now, Britain was on the defensive this time, and Churchill very much wanted to strike back, so he was planning on using his commando units to do this. So at Arran, when they were trained, they would stay like billeted with local families, essentially, and they would look after them and feed them and whatnot. And this is where Blair got known for his rambunctious behaviour. Owen and Blair were actually responsible for weapons training, and they kept much of the regiment's ammo in their billet. And as Blair noted in a letter to his mother, the ammo came in very handy for splitting up large lumps of coal in the fire, and it was not unknown for the soldiers, in particular Blair, to improve the ventilation of the cottage they were staying in by shooting out the window panes, so the glazier was kept very busy. And this is where you get a kind of glimpse into the relationship between Owen and Blair. So Owen wasn't, or Blair wouldn't have been the kind of guy to take orders that he disagreed with lightly, and he wouldn't, you know, listen to someone whenever he got into one of his moods, shall we say. But as he was known for being rowdy, one fellow soldier who served with him at the time said that the only person that was able to control Paddy when he cut loose was Owen McGonagall. Owen had been known to point a revolver at him and say, "I'll shoot you, Blair," and inevitably Paddy would stop what he was doing because he knew that they'd all meant it. So we knew how to control him.
That's pretty extreme behaviour, let's be honest.
It is. It was an extreme time, very different time. Yeah.
And they had a very close friendship, and we'll discuss that later, I suppose, because Owen McGonagall died in the war. That perhaps, I mean, when we say Blair means best friend, do we really mean only friend, or is it more than that?
I think Blair had quite a few, you know, acquaintances back home in Ballymena, you know, around the bar, the Adair Arms Hotel and stuff. But he didn't keep anyone very close to him, I would say, other than, you know, his mother. But Owen would have been, yeah, his closest, his friend, his companion, yeah.
So, from the commandos, which was an elite group of soldiers for specific reasons and specific raids, and we remember the films, the commandos. But from that, then another elite, another tiny group, comes about, the SAS.
July 1941, L Detachment of the SAS Brigade came into being in Egypt. The title was to deceive the Axis into believing that a complete British airborne brigade was in the Middle East.
Well, can we explain what the original difference was between the commandos and the SAS?
The commandos would have been, you know, they were an, you know, official British Army regiment, but when the SAS was first formed, it was almost like a guinea pig kind of trial. David Stirling came up with the idea, and essentially what they would pick their own missions. They would gather their own resources, and they would be dropped into a desert base, and they would launch their own missions from there. They wouldn't operate under the normal chain of command, which the commandos would have done, and they were also responsible for their own training. So it was very much a self-contained unit, whereas the commando units were more spread out.
And it was tiny.
Yeah, it was only 50 or so members to start off with. Obviously, the numbers grew after that. But yeah, no, it was very, very tiny. I mean, because the British Army, the hierarchy, whenever David Stirling requested permission to do this, they were very hesitant. So they were hesitant to put up, you know, many weapons, or they were giving them official training and whatnot. They kind of just said, right, if you want to do this, you can sort yourself out. And that's what they did.
And there's no doubt, I mean, that sometimes these raids carried out by a very small number of people managed to.
You're talking about groups of maybe four or five people at each airfield. Yeah.
I in researching this podcast, there's one member of this team who said they believe that they destroyed more Axis aircraft in North Africa than the RAF did. Now, I'm not sure if we can really verify that.
Anecdotally, there was a story apparently when one of his superiors, to David Stirling, kind of guffawed at this idea. And David Stirling had a bet with him. They said, look, in the next few months, we'll destroy more enemy planes on the ground than the RAF will in the sky. Whether or not that's anecdotal and it actually happened, who knows? But
and again, we're exposed by the media and film today to the idea of special forces, you know, this tiny group of people who go in and raid, and maybe you're talking about half a dozen people, but it was very revolutionary at the time.
Oh, at the time, yeah. It wasn't the way things were done. It was very much went against what we call the terms of conventional warfare. That was a gamble that a lot of people weren't willing to take, because after all, these people being dropped in behind enemy lines and weren't given very many chances of survival.
And like Owen's personality, there's a similar background, I suppose, rugby to an extent, law, middle class, sense of adventure perhaps, and this quite unconventional behaviour. Did Owen get up to what Paddy Meehan would have got up to in terms of drinking, in terms of breaking the rules of the British Army?
No, not at all, really. Whereas Blair was seen as, you know, anti-establishment in terms of his views toward authority figures. Owen would be very much, he was known for being a huge character, very gregarious, got on with everyone, everyone liked him, didn't really butt heads very much, so he was kind of chalk and cheese really compared to Blair Meehan. I suppose that's perhaps why they were able to get on so well together, because Blair could cut loose and Owen would be able to wrangle him in, and both would inspire each other to a degree.
Now, Owen McGonagall didn't survive World War II, as we've mentioned. What can we say about his death?
Well, contrary to what is depicted in the BBC series, his death is kind of shrouded in a degree of mystery. Now, what happened was, this was the first and only parachute drop that the SAS did in Egypt, even though they were originally formed as a kind of a parachute detachment. But in August 1941, about 50 members of L Detachment SAS flew over, November 1941, they flew to parachute into Libya behind enemy lines, and their mission was to attack these three coastal Axis air bases on foot in Timini and Gazala. Now, it was, the reports from the time suggest it perhaps wasn't the best idea to even undergo this mission at the time, because the weather was terrible. No one had ever parachuted into the desert before. And as it happened, of the 50 members that went on that mission, only about half of them actually returned. Owen, in his grip, parachuted in the desert, and he was never heard from again. It is assumed that he either most likely died in the parachute drop, or he perhaps survived the drop, but he was either captured and killed, or simply died from the elements.
And he was just 1 month shy of his 21st birthday.
Yes,
we've been speaking about someone, and you would assume he was older.
Very much so. Yeah, it's strange. Even a lot of these characters, I think the average age in the SAS at that time was only 25. But yeah, Owen was actually became the weapons instructor for L Attachment, and he was only 20 years old at the time. But all told, when you actually take a step back, although it seems they did an awful lot over this period, it was only for Owen anyway. It was only the space of maybe a year, 2 years, from when he got into training in Aberdeenshire, or Ballymena rather, with RUR, to when he died.
And his death had a huge impact on Paddy Meehan.
Oh yeah, very much so. I think from a lot of his contemporaries at the time, he just said he was never the same again. Fly off the handle more than usual, and he would write letters to Owen's mother, and in one of them he tells of going out when he was supposed to be in R&R, but he decided to returned to Libya, to where the Owen's drop zone was, in that ill-fated mission, and to try to recover his body, which he never did.
Now, Owen's brother Ambrose, as we've mentioned, he also joined the Royal Ulster Rifles in Ballymena. We've mentioned he broke his leg, and that took him away from the SAS, but he did end up in what we would now describe as the Special Forces, the Special Boat Squadron. Again, educated in Clonowswood College in County Kildare. He was an athlete. He won a Leinster School's rugby cap. Then he went to Queen's and he joins up. What can we say about Robert Ambrose?
Well, actually, he spent 2 years studying arts at Queen's University, which he described as two inglorious years. But then he decided maybe I should follow the family footsteps here and get into law. So he was student at the King's Inn in the autumn of 1938. But as we say, with the outbreak of war, he signed up with the Royal Ulster Rifles. Now, he served with the 12th Commando between 1943 and 4, and he served in the Aegean with the Special Boat Service, which was the SAS's sister regiment, even though it was formed quite a bit after the SAS was. He was awarded a Military Cross in 1943 with a bar the following year, and mentioned in dispatches. So he was a very successful soldier. I think he retired with the rank of Major. And then he, you know, after he was demobilised, he went back to his law studies. Now, at the time,
he had a very distinguished military career. Much longer than his brother Owen, and we can see many distinctions there. So and he had risen to the ranks. So I think that's significant. And when he gets out, he goes back into the family trade, back into the law.
Originally, actually, he became a bar student at Queen's University, but at the time he would have been required to have an undergraduate degree to do that, but because of his military service, he was exempted from this. And then he completed his studies, and he was called to the Northern Bar in 1948 at the age of 30, and he became a Queen's Counsel, taking silk in 1956. And this was interesting because a couple of years after that, although judicial appointments at the time, this was about just over a decade before the start of the outbreak of the Troubles, they were predominantly reserved for unionists. Protestant Unionists. But it was decided to, when it was decided to increase the complement of Northern Ireland High Court judges by two, McGonagall was the obvious choice, Ambrose, and he was made High Court judge.
You know, judicial appointments at the time predominantly reserved for Unionists. I mean, what more did he have to do? I mean, this was a major, you know, who'd taken the oath of allegiance to the crown, who had served in the SBS in World War
II. I think that's what probably actually swung it in the end. And if it wasn't for that, we probably wouldn't have never have.
And I find that fascinating because, you know, there's nothing to indicate in the background of the McGonagall family that they were Irish nationalists.
No, not at all.
I would venture to say that they were people happy, as we would say today, people happy with the status quo.
Well, in terms of the literature that's written about them, they just don't seem to go into very much in terms of their political persuasion, other than to say they were first and foremost Ulster men. But yeah, I would dare say if you had to put a bet on it in this day and age, they would have been leaning towards the Ulster Unionist kind of end of things.
Now, the Troubles come along, the Diplock courts come along, and Ambrose presided over many of these.
Yeah.
Can you tell us anything more about that?
Yeah, so essentially, as people will probably know, Diplock courts are courts that sitting without judges because from fear of people being intimidated and whatnot, and just the current climate at the time. So Ambrose presided over many of these. He was known for being a very stern character, so you knew where you sat with him, but very fair in the same time. He was actually promoted to the Court of Appeal in 1975, and it's been noted in some reports that due to the threat of terrorism, he was known for carrying a gun underneath his robe, which just shows you how dangerous it could be to be a judge at that time. I mean, there were cases of judges being murdered.
Catholic judges were particularly despised, targeted.
They were seen as traitors, essentially, and in one, probably most notorious, would probably be the word, in a 1977 ruling of his, he appeared to condone a degree of physical ill treatment, falling short of torture or inhuman and degrading treatment to obtain admissions from detainees while in custody, because there was, you would have heard, anyone that would be a student of history, of Troubles history, there's known for being cases of mistreatment in Castlereagh at the time, interrogation centre. But Lord Justice McGonagall, as he was at the time, said that in this ruling, that a blow did not necessarily render a statement given inadmissible. And obviously this created quite a lot of criticism, and it became known as the Torturer's Charter.
And Ambrose died in September 1979 at the quite young age of 61. His son, Owen McGonagall, is currently, isn't he, a leading barrister?
He is indeed. He followed in the family line. Ambrose's son, Owen, obviously named after Ambrose's brother or his uncle. He went into law himself, and that continues to this day.
Did Blair Meehan ever meet up with Ambrose, or did he ever have much contact with Ambrose?
When Blair Meehan left the services, he went back to his profession in law. He was secretary for the Law Society, and him and Ambrose were known to meet up and go out for a few drinks on occasion. There was one actually anecdotal story where they had a big argument, nearly got to blows after a night of drinking, and Ambrose stormed off, I think it was a hotel bar at the time. And Blair got in his car and at about 5 miles per hour crept up slowly behind him just to make sure he got home safely. So yeah, no, they stayed close together, and Ambrose brought his son Owen to meet Blair when he was working in the garden of his property. And Blair gave young Owen, I think it was his father's silver cigarette case.
And just a final question, I suppose, in terms of the David Stirling, the founder of the SAS, and these characters, again, brought to life by the BBC series. Mm-hmm. I mean, what part do you think that Owen McGonagall has in the legacy of the SAS?
Well, he was the founding member of the SAS, and as I say, he died on their first and last mission. So, it was a mission.
Their first and his last.
Their first and his last, but it was the first and last parachute mission. Sorry, rather, first and last parachute mission that they ever did, and because of how disastrous it went, and Owen lost his life, and it was because his body's been never found. There's a degree of myth behind it, but I think he's an example of the SAS's daring, which they became known for. After all, that's their motto: who dares wins.
Andrew Madden, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This episode of The Bell Tale was produced by myself, Kieran Dunbar, along with Andrew Madden. The sound design was by Graham Davidson. The clips you heard were from British Pathé and the History Channel.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.